You know, when you see it on TVs and movies, disasters mean every person for themselves. It means stocking up on guns and ammo. It means batten down the hatches and just surviving. But what's the reality about making it through a disaster and finding yourself on the other side? That's this hour on The Lee Rayburn Show. What questions do you have about surviving a disaster? And we've had a few here this year already in Wisconsin. Or if you have a story about what it took to make it through a disaster, you are welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our guests are the authors of the Emergency Playbook, A Bunker-Free Guide to Disaster Preparation. And I think I'm just going to let you guys sort of introduce yourselves here, because you bring such different points of view to the table that I really appreciate the both perspectives. Chris Begley, I'll start with you. Welcome to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write the Emergency Playbook.
Well, hi, Lee, and thanks for having us on here. Well, I'm an archaeologist, and I've also been a wilderness survival instructor, and I wrote a book a few years ago called The Next Apocalypse about how things fall apart and why we think about them the way we do and how we get it wrong. And Amy contacted me about writing this book, a practical guide that would bring some of those ideas she had to life in a way that was accessible and really useful.
Amy Edelman, you are the other author of the Emergency Playbook. Where are you coming from?
Well, I live right outside of New York City. I've spent most of my working career in public relations and marketing for consumer companies, fashion-related companies. And I read a New York Magazine cover story back in 2019. David Wallace Wells wrote about hothouse Earth and what was going to happen in the future. And I got a little concerned. And having been most of my life kind of like needing to be in control and organized, I thought it was a really good time to think about what I'd need to be prepared in a situation, not even that extreme, but just if there's power outages or, a boil water notice, would I have what I needed and would my family have, by extension, what we needed to get through till we got to the other side of the disaster. And so I started thinking about a book that would appeal not necessarily to the doomsday preppers, but to other people like me, people who are living in the suburbs, women more than men, maybe, because we tend to be organized and take care of the house and kids. So sure. That's how I came to that perspective of the book. And I happened to read Chris's book and reached out to fangirl a little because it was a really good book and mentioned that I had this idea. And he got on board, and that's how we got to here.
So you have a wilderness survival instructor in our guest, Chris Begley. You have a New York City adjacent mom and Amy Edelman, and together they have come together to bring us the Emergency Playbook, A Bunker-Free Guide to Disaster Preparation. And Chris, you mentioned what we get wrong when it comes to disaster planning. Could you give us some ideas of some of the myths that you dispel in the Emergency Playbook?
Yeah, one of the things that got me started in all of this was watching sort of apocalyptic movies.
Yep.
And it's always, a small group of survivors. And of course, we know the sort of doomsday prepper bunker mentality that we are often presented. And it really just flew in the face of everything I knew as an archaeologist. As an archaeologist, of course, we're always studying societies that have collapsed or transformed, because they all do eventually. And we see that there are so many ways in which it is really the community and not individuals that support us in those times of crisis and getting through it. And that was really one of the big things I think we get wrong. that we can get through it by ourselves, or that we ought to focus on protecting our little stash of stuff from the rest of the community. That's just the opposite of how it works.
So the opposite means that we combine resources, that we come together, that there is a need to know your neighbor, Amy, but there is also a feeling that that's something we don't normally do anymore in this age of online and internet. We're more likely to know somebody on a social media site than we are to the house next door or across the street.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is a problem. I happen to live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of kids, so there's a lot of block parties.
Sure.
And we moved into a neighborhood kind of in between houses where the kids all grew up together. So the neighbors do know each other. But I absolutely agree, especially with social media. And I think people need to understand that your Instagram fans and your Facebook friends are not, you know, in most cases going to be there to help you when, you know, when you need actual help. So yes, I mean, I do think that people need to make an effort, especially these days, to get to know the people around them. Even if you're in a rural community, you need to know your neighbor. There's the possibility that you can help them, that they can help you, whether it's skills that they have that you don't, or supplies that they have that you don't. This is very much kind of a mutual aid situation. And again, the stakes are pretty high, even when the stakes aren't high, even if it's just a power outage for a few days. I know you guys have had some like crazy weather there.
Sure.
In Wisconsin.
Sure.
But just being able to reach out and say, hey, you know, you have water, we have food, you know, just combining resources and skills will help, you know, make the situation easier by far.
And Chris, when we're talking about just not having electricity for a few days, that means a lot more than your freezer thawing out in the heat of the summer and the cold of the winter. It can be the difference between life and death. So if your electricity's out for a few days in Wisconsin, be it summer or winter, what steps should you take?
Well, these are steps you have to take beforehand, of course.
Huh.
And one of the things is, imagine it's winter there in Wisconsin, and I lived in Wisconsin for a couple of winters, so I appreciate the winters there. This could involve a variety of things. It depends on where you live. Do you live in an apartment? Do you live in a big old Victorian house? You know, you might want to close off part of the house. You need to have ways to keep warm, and that's going to start with clothing and things like blankets and sleeping bags and all of that. You might have alternative ways to heat your house. You might have alternative ways to create electricity to do all of that. You know, and one thing that we need to realize, and I suppose most people do after this happens once, is even if you have, say, heat from natural gas, usually you're going to be dependent on electricity for the thermostat, for the blowers, and all of these other things. So almost everyone's going to be affected by this. But in those cases, you know, it's really figure out what you can do to protect yourself from those elements. And of course, it goes even beyond that. If it was an extended power outage, say that there was something that really disrupted infrastructure like a flood, and you might have a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you know, that can even affect the water supply, because you know, your water pressure is generated from electric pumps that pump it up into a water tower. If you live in a tall building, the building itself will pump it up, you know, to the rooftop to create that pressure. So you could be without water. And so it opens up a whole other set of issues.
And you begin to understand the importance of knowing your neighbors and having the opportunity to pool resources and protect each other. In the hot weather, I'm reminded that it's important to go and check on your neighbors to make sure they are okay, or to have neighbors checking on you. But as you mentioned, you break down this book into three parts: planning, essentials, and then scenarios. And Chris, preparation is step one, of course. But there is this apprehension to prepare, I feel like, and you mentioned mention this in the book, and Amy, I'll ask you about this idea of normalcy bias and why it's all ingrained in us somehow.
It's basically from the beginning of humanity, when we knew that if there was something in front of us that prevented it, that presented a danger, that we better get out of there. It was a protective kind of thing. So normalcy bias is just basically thinking that tomorrow is just going to be the same as today, with few major changes. And there are other biases kind of wrapped up in there as well. But the way I look at preparedness really is that, you know, it's kind of part of growing up, you know. you learn, it is though, you know, you prepare for a new school semester, you prepare for a test, you know, you prepare to get married, you prepare to have kids, you prepare to go out in the job market. And then if there's an instance where you're not prepared, I kind of feel like the way that makes you feel, you learn from that. Most people learn from that. So the whole idea of being prepared and being a prepper, to me, it's not really related so much. I mean, because it is something that, you know, we've been dealing with, most of us, since we were kids. You know, you learn to be prepared. If it's going to be cold, then you bring a sweater. If it's going to be hot, you know, and so on.
But that's where the normalcy bias comes in. We plan for these, we prepare for these things because they're normal parts of life. But tornadoes and disasters and floods, financial crises, those are things that we are not less likely to prepare for, I feel, Amy, because that's not a normal part of our life, and we just expect normal to continue to roll along, even though even in our backyard in Wisconsin here last week, normal suddenly stopped.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the case throughout the most of the world, you know, at this point. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to continue this way, if not to get worse. So it is a shame if this has to become the new normal in order for people to prepare. But I do think that that's how it's going to be. So, you know, it's good timing for the book. I will say that.
I will say from my perspective in training or working in journalism, that one of the things you have to do is identify your biases, acknowledge your biases, and then know where your biases are so that you can work around them or over them or through them so that they don't interfere with your work. So here is a bias that all of us have that would interfere potentially with the opportunity of getting through the worst parts of the unexpected. So when it comes to planning then, Chris, I get this idea of, in fact, I've got the list, a list in front of me, and knowing neighbors is on that list. But so is exercise. And I found that interesting, that exercising would be a good way of preparing in a way. And so is basic first aid. And so is basic foraging and food.
Yeah. You know, one of the, if we think about preparedness, you know, I would typically break it down into knowledge. That you would acquire, into some skills you would acquire. And then finally, and this is actually probably further down the list, the gear, the tools, the stuff. And, you know, part of the place to start is with that knowledge. And that's going to include, of course, knowing your neighbors. Who are they? What can they do? What might they need? How will you work together if that has to happen? You know, exercise is one that is, you know, it's just easier to move if you've been moving. And as you know, when things are disrupted, one of the things that you often have to do is move around a lot more than you normally would. You know, maybe you have to walk somewhere. Maybe you're just constantly adjusting in ways that you're not. And so that's just one thing that can, you know, make it easier for you. Well, as you get older in general, probably is a good idea, but certainly when you encounter something like that.
That's Chris Beck. Amy, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I kind of want to bring it back to like have fun. Like, when did learning something new, become like something that you don't want to do? I mean, if you look at our parents, our grandparents, our great grandparents, they had so many skills that we no longer have. And, granted, a lot of people are really busy these days, whether it's work or worrying about work, but the time that you spent scrolling or, looking at social media, learn a new skill. I mean, I just like signed up for a Red Cross class in like CPR because, hey, it's interesting, it's fun. We're like gardening now, same thing, why not? It's fun to do. So I think the way that you look at this, again, through the lens, if you will, of optimism or doing something that makes you feel good, which working out does, it's good for, all of those good things that dopamine, is it? I don't
Yeah,
remember.
release the good chemicals, make you feel
Yes,
good.
exactly. So, again, I don't think, I think if people come at it as something that's scary or something that you have to do, that's not the way in. I really think it should be more about doing things that make you feel empowered. Certainly, being prepared for any situation is a very empowering thing.
Yeah, and I'll say that even with my wilderness survival classes, which are teaching you things that you're probably only going to use in a bad situation, people do it for fun. People do it because it's fun to learn those skills and to think you have some connection with, I don't know, things people might have known how to do in the past.
That's Chris Begley along with Amy Edelman. They are the authors of The Emergency Playbook, a bunker-free guide to disaster preparation. There's one other part of preparing that I think deserves mention, and that is, and it seems to fly in the face of the movies that we see of disasters and people persevering through them, and that is the importance of staying calm and keeping, keeping your mind level and finding a way through this that does not have you screaming, shouting, or acting out. Chris, what's the importance of keeping calm?
Well, it affects everything that you do. I mean, think about when you're upset or you're in a state where you're now not thinking clearly. That's ultimately what it is when you keep calm. I mean, the importance of not panicking in an emergency situation is well known in something like, scuba diving. One of the first things you learn in an emergency is to stay calm, analyze the problem. And in fact, there's sayings like smooth is slow, slow is fast. In other words, in these different things, you keep things calm and ultimately you'll be able to do things better.
How do you
And
prepare
so
for
that,
that, though?
well, one of the things is that you prepare. And this, just preparation is something that can make you feel more confident. You've done it, you've thought about it. These are not all new situations. You have a plan. A few years ago, many of us, I think in the eastern US, were affected by a complete cell phone outage. I think something had happened in Nashville. And that day you realize, well, not only is that how I communicate with everybody, but when you're out of the house and you're not on your Wi-Fi at home, you're probably using internet to message people and use your GPS and everything else. And so suddenly you have this situations that's really different and can be disconcerting. If you've planned for that, if you've talked to your kids, your family, whoever it is you're communicating with, and you have some plan on what do we do if this happens, that just alleviates the stress. And that's part of that staying calm.
So staying calm means having a plan for a disaster. And Amy, as you mentioned, having a plan should be able to be fun, as you write in the book, less Mad Max and more Power of Positive Prepping.
Yes. Yes. It's you can equate being prepared for something and potentially practicing what you've learned, putting it into practice. And again, that also could be something fun, dress rehearsal, so to speak. The more prepared you are, the less stressed out you're going to be. There obviously are extensions of that. Personally, I discovered meditation, I don't know, maybe 9 or 10 years ago, and I do that twice a day, and I find that that really helps me. You know, the thing is too, is even without an emergency, you know, people are very stressed these days. You know, anxiety levels are like through the roof. I mean, you know, so no surprise there. So it kind of behooves us, because stress is not good physically. I mean, it really, you know, creates illness. And if you're stressed in your head, it's going to show up in your body, in your, you know, illness and that kind of thing. So I think, again, even if everything was sunshine and lollipops, there is still a reason to work on your mental health. Most people are stressed, and, you know, to find a way, whether that's being prepared or meditation or, but I think it's just a positive attribute to have, you know, even on a regular Tuesday.
So in these turbulent times, we're all getting some practice in staying calm, as long as we're staying calm through these turbulent times. Chris, you part of the book says, and I took this to heart, that there is a desire to be constructive after disaster, and this desire is universal. Why is this just part of our makeup, and where does it come from?
Well, I'm not sure if this is an evolutionary thing where after a disaster, it behooves the group to get together and get through it, or if it's something else, but it certainly seems to be something that happens at least for the first few days. I mean, you know, people have a remarkable ability to get over their newfound cooperation, but, you know, certainly for a while, this lasts. And like all of this, like staying calm or even how you react to a disaster, thinking about it beforehand changes how you react. If you know that you need to stay calm, that puts you in a better position than if you've never thought about staying calm. If you know that you need to cooperate with the community, that puts you in a different situation.
This also is an opportunity to build community too, isn't it? Even without disaster, the preparing for it helps build it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, partly, you know, having to get out and meet your neighbors, you know, maybe that gives something away about me. But, you know, I mean, I've lived in the same place for a long time, and I know my neighbors to some degree, but like a lot of people, mostly I'm not here, or if I am here at my house, I'm doing something. And as an archaeologist, I'm often gone for a long time. You know, I have a community of people, of academics or archaeologists or enthusiasts of some group that tend to occupy your time. And so your neighbors are just people you sort of talk to while you're out there. And you may not know that much about them. So yeah, it is taking that necessary first step of getting to know the neighbors certainly will help build community. I mean, hopefully, I guess it depends on your neighbors, but mostly, I suspect mostly it will.
Because the desire to be constructive immediately following a disaster is universal. Our lack of ability to prepare may be due to a normalcy bias where we just expect things to stay the same. But don't let that bias get in the way of the opportunity to build community through preparation and the opportunity to stay calm through any sort of disaster, because you have a plan to get through it. All strategies from our guests, Chris Begley and Amy Edelman, and their new book, The Emergency Playbook, A Bunker-Free Guide to Disaster Preparation. We invite you to the conversation. I've sort of monopolized it myself. We'll get to you when we continue. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email us, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News. What's it take to make it through a disaster? To make sure your family stays safe through a disaster? And what can we do to better prepare, be ready in the event that it may come? And considering the tornadoes that struck in the Fox Cities last Monday, considering the drought that is ongoing in the northern part of Wisconsin, and the fact that there is this fear of uncertainty and instability, that anything could happen at any moment, and that should at least alleviate some of the normalcy bias that may keep you from preparing appropriately. Our guests are the authors of The Emergency Playbook, A Bunker-Free Guide to Disaster Preparation, Chris Begley and Amy Edelman joining us this hour, and answering your questions, or if you have a short story to share about how you made it through a disaster, please do. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Ann in Marshfield next. Hi, Ann.
Hello, Lee and Chris and Amy. Excuse me, I have to clear my throat. I am a licensed radio amateur, and the radio amateur community practices for emergencies. What I was wondering was, do you talk in the book about replacement communication to cell phones, et cetera?
Before we get there, Ann, how does the ham community prepare?
We have equipment that supposedly we won't need to depend on electricity, although you have to be prepared, of course.
Right.
You have to have your batteries charged, and you have to have small AA batteries available. And then we do have what we call go kits. It's like a toolbox. You open it up, and it's got a solar panel in there.
Sure.
And then it's got a antenna attached to a weight, and we throw the weight up in a tree, and then we get an antenna up in the tree. So we practice all this stuff.
Whoa. Ann, and I wanted to ask you first, because I know the answer from our guests is absolutely. They do detail alternative communication and its value in a disaster. Chris, why don't you explain a little bit about it?
Yeah, we talk about, you know, some of the different common different types, from walkie-talkies to CB radios to GMRS and ham radios. And, you know, the sort of realistic ways in which those will work and what it requires, you know, and communication ultimately becomes one of the big issues, not only you communicating with your people, but getting communication, you know, getting the information that you need and all of that. And so that's a very big concern.
Amy, the other part of this communication is when you're dealing with an emergency or a disaster is getting news. So if you're disconnected, where do you go for the information that you can trust and act upon?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, as you know, it's getting harder and harder to find resources that have information that you can depend on. But, you know, we use battery powered radios we have. And, you know, again, it's every day it changes in terms of where you can get information that you can trust. But that is one of the most important concerns, is where you go to get information you can trust.
And thank you so much for the call. And Chris, go ahead.
I was just going to say, continuing on what Amy was saying, that, you know, one of the things that becomes really important is certainly in the initial response to oil and leading up to some sort of crisis is, you know, getting that information. And one way is to sign up for these alerts that come from governmental sources, and those often come on your cell phone. So if you're in a situation where you've not had power for days, you know, that may or may not be an option. Increasingly, we're seeing that these things are less reliable or defunded. I mean, think about NOAA, think about FEMA. And so there are, you know, a variety of state level, local level sources that can help you get the information. I mean, think about, you know, tornado watches and warnings and all of that. Most of us get those through, you know, local media.
Yeah. I the subtitle of the book is A Bunker-Free Guide to Disaster Preparation. Chris, why isn't a bunker an appropriate way to prepare for a disaster? Why wouldn't I stock up on guns and ammo and just hunker down?
Well, I mean, let's take that to sort of its logical conclusion. First of all, if it's a flood or tornado, that's not going to help you. What are you going to do? You know, be there with your, you know, thank God you had ammo for that tornado. But the, you know, so those are really only appropriate for some sort of end of the world scenario, right? Apocalyptic scenario. And then even think about that. You know, how much are you going to stock up? And ultimately, it's about rebuilding these systems that we depend on. You can't stock up for the rest of your life, or maybe you can, you know, if you're an old person, but not your children, not the rest of the people. You have to rebuild that agricultural system. You have to rebuild the education system, transportation system, all of these things that may have, you know, fallen apart for one reason or another. And so one of the reasons that that's not a proper response is that it's just a short-term response at best, if it's ever particularly useful. Mm. You know, secondly, I would say that, you know, there's this fantasy of what I would call a landscape of violence that, you know, somehow in this emergency, we're going to be freed to do what we want. And that will include use all these guns that we've accumulated and all of these skills. And, you know, that is also unappealing, you know, when you think about it. That's of course, not sustainable.
The fantasy of violence. But that is what's all, you know, quite often, more often than not, depicted in entertainment. But I imagine that's because if you were to depict an actual survival scenario that would be effective, that would be knowing your neighbors, preparing ahead, that it wouldn't have quite the appeal on the big screen or on a streaming service.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you have zombies, perhaps, but, you know, as far as we can tell,
yeah,
unlikely to be one of the things you're going to face.
I was going to say, of all the worst-case scenarios that are detailed in the emergency playbook, zombies was not in there, I noticed.
No.
And I will say, too, that another reason why, you know, being prepared might not be as attractive to a female audience is because the whole violence thing is a very typical male-driven thing. You know, it's how big are your muscles? How big is your gun? You know, how big is your bunker? Size does not matter in a situation like this, really. It's really more about, again, knowing your neighbor, being organized, having what you need, staying calm. These are not generally thought of to be strong male attributes. So this is
just to comment on that too. This, you know, part of the reason why this is the bunker free, or we wanted to put that on the cover, was because a lot of these skills have sort of been co-opted in this misogynistic, patriarchal way where suddenly, you know, being prepared or having these skills is a manly thing. I mean, I'll tell you that I've worked around the world in some remote areas, and who's out there chopping the wood? It's women more than men. Who's doing all of these things? Think about your own childhood. Who was prepared? Who did you go to when you needed the Band-Aid, the, you know, the candy in church or whatever it was, you know? It wasn't, you know, looking around for the most masculine person. That's just not the, you know, so this is part of the issue. We have this, and it's part of the fantasy that's particular to, you know, maybe this part of the world where we see these skills as somehow masculine and manly, and there's no reason to think about it that way.
It's just yet another misconception or another fantasy, but it doesn't seem to have any basis in reality. Our guests, Chris Begley, Amy Edelman, authors of The Emergency Playbook, A Bunker-Free Guide to Disaster Preparation. Back to your questions and stories next at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Mike in Madison now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. So I'm a partial prepper, and as a former Eagle Scout and someone who's lived a lot of their life in the woods, there's a lot of stuff out there, but looking back to the one thing that will actually work in no matter just about any situation you're in is look directly at the Amish and how the Amish have survived and what they're doing, candles and lamp oil, canning. Salting your food, to be honest, something like salt, a preservative to preserve your food will be worth more than bullets in the long run. But for all the preppers out there, you really want something, go buy books on how the Amish get by, and that'll be the best thing you can have in your bunker or on your shelf at home, just in general preparedness.
Mike, thank you so much for the call. And Chris, will salt be worth more than bullets in the aftermath of a disaster?
I think about anything will be worth more than bullets, but but yeah, think about a case where you are without the infrastructure that we're used to. You have people like the Amish that live without it voluntarily, and so of course they have ways to deal with that. I've lived in places where there was no water or electricity, and the folks in those places had never had that, and you know it was very comfortable, and you know what you did was modeled around that. On the other hand, I've lived in cities where we had 12-hour power cuts every day, and it was incredibly uncomfortable because things weren't built to work that way. And so yeah, looking at people that live in a way that's going to mirror the situation in which you're going to be potentially going to be there is one way to do it. And of course, in this book, we talk about disasters at a lot of different levels. You know, after a tornado, you know, you're probably not going to adopt, you know, lifeways like the Amish, but in other situations, certainly some of those skills are going to be super useful.
Mike, thank you so much for the call. Dennis emailed to say, in emergencies, we need our energy reserves for mental focus so that our decisions maximize our effectiveness and the efficiency of our efforts. Not being prepared and worrying waste energy and time when we can least afford it. It's something you mentioned in the book that stuck with me, and that you should expect to be uncomfortable and aggravated by everybody after a disaster, and you need to plan for that as well, Amy.
Yeah, you do. I mean, and it's funny because we have neighbors behind us who play music very loudly, very late at night. And it's funny because I thought about that particular part in the book. So yes, that is a challenge for sure. I don't know what else to say with regards to that, but yes.
You've had some preparation now for being uncomfortable and aggravated.
Yes.
And you would take that into account, and you don't want to waste that energy, which is one of the reasons you want to stay calm. But Amy, you talked about it, you know, you're coming from this from a suburban New York City point of view. You're coming from this perspective from a mother's point of view. So I want to know from you what a go bag looks like for a family. So you'd have a bag ready to prepare to evacuate in the event of an emergency. What do you have in it?
Well, yes, and we have several bags because it should be one for anybody who's able to carry it. So, you know, even if it's a 5-year-old child, they can, and kids like to be included. You know, again, like parents think about this, it's like, oh no, it will totally wreck them. No. Kids know what's going on. They want to be included. And again, if you frame it as something that's scary, then yes, they'll be scared. If you frame it as something that's a challenge or an adventure, you might be surprised that they rise to the occasion. Mm. So we pack the go bags in order of the rule of three, which is in the book, which is the things that you're going to need in order of their importance, depending on what the emergency is. So the first thing is that you need to be able to survive in a harsh environment. So that would be, you know, clothing, mm-hmm. you know, or so that kind of thing. The next would be water. So water is very heavy and kind of hard to carry. So you should have something in addition to carrying, you know, a reasonable supply of water that can clean water. You know, if you run out, that there's, so you can clean the water that you encounter. After that is food. So again, you should carry, you know, whether it's cereal bars or something that you can, is kind of like ready-made beef jerky, that kind of thing. Flashlights, very important. Phone chargers, very, very important. Going back to what you asked before in terms of being able to access news so you can find out what's going on. You should have waterproof bags to put things in just in case you encounter it, whether it's raining. You should have something, a tarp, which is, you know, can be very lightweight should you have to camp out overnight somewhere. A lighter, matches, something to be able to spark a fire. And then the important thing, which I should kind of back up, is you should not pack a go bag that you can't then pick up and actually carry, which is then goes back to what we were talking earlier about being physically fit, you yeah. know? So yes.
Your go bag actually has to go.
Yes, Chris, exactly.
Right. Yeah, there, you know, in addition to all of those things that Amy mentioned, one of the things that for a lot of disaster will be important are important papers that you're going to need yes. to recover from this. And this could be deeds to your house or your cars or insurance papers or birth certificates or marriage certificates or adoption certificates or whatever it is that you may need. You know, hard copies of most of that would probably be best, but at the very least, something like a flash drive that has digital versions of those or both, and maybe even have them on the cloud somewhere. And one way to do that, of course, is just to email all of that to yourself, which then you can recover even if you don't have access to some other kind of storage. But, you know, I mean, imagine if you're a situation like a flood or a wildfire, you may come back to find it's all gone.
Yeah.
And so that's part of what might be in that bag too.
So when I think, and the third part of the emergency playbook is scenarios, and you run through a bunch of them, and a bunch of them would be potential and possible. The drought we're seeing in the northern Wisconsin parts right now, flooding, which we now see in the spring around our waterways through Wisconsin, extreme heat, extreme cold, tornadoes last week in the Fox Cities, wildfire, dangerous air quality, civil unrest, economic crisis. Chris, how do I even begin to prepare for them all? These are all different crises, but is there a baseline that would get me, that would give me a fighting chance?
Yeah. The you know, one of the basic things to do would be, of course, get to know your community and make a plan with your family on what do you do if you stay and lose certain things like communication, or if you need to go. Especially if you need to go and you've lost communication, where do you meet? How do you know that everybody's safe? All of that would apply in many of those situations. You know, but the other thing is to analyze the place that you live and decide which of those are the most likely. So for instance, where I am here in Kentucky, earthquakes are not a particular worry. Mm-hmm. You know, wildfires less than someplace like, you know, obviously Washington State or California. And so that would be a way to start. You know, in some of these things, the preparation can take a long time. Think about preparing for a drought or for extreme heat. That might involve something like landscaping or planting trees or things that are not going to be, you know, an overnight thing. So some of it, some of it's relatively long term. And, you know, one of the big things that we try to emphasize is that it's not something you do all at once. You start taking these steps, and some of the easiest steps might be prepare that go bag. You know, it has a relatively small list of things. Prepare your documents. That's going to get you thinking about things. Go through these scenarios and see what might affect you and what sorts of things you can change. For instance, if you lived in an area with wildfires, is your yard and is your house conditioned in a way that's going to maximize your chance of making it through something like that?
Amy, I wanted to ask you, since you're wrangling up the family here for a disaster, what we do about our pets?
Well, you need a go bag for your pets, that's for sure. Start with that. And it depends on your pet, honestly. Ours happens to bite. We have a dog that happens to be nippy. So it's going to be we've had conversations about this. It's going to be really hard. And I don't think he's ever spent a day in, in a carrier. So it's going to be difficult, but it should absolutely be something that's discussed.
Sure.
You're going to take the pet with you, and you need to figure out what is the best case scenario for doing that. And I would back up too and say, you know, a lot of people think, and this is something else that stops people, that getting prepared is going to be very costly. And I would say that the place where you start is having a plan. And that does not cost anything. Like, know how you're going to get out of town if you need to get out of town. Know who you're going to stay with if, you know, you need to get out of the immediate area. Discuss with your family, because I do have two kids, but they're out of the house. So, you know, in different parts of the, states. So how do you communicate? What are your steps going to be in terms of, you know, is there a meeting place? So, and again, what are you going to do with, what are you going to do with Gordon, the dog who bites everybody? but the first steps don't have to be spending money.
Sure.
If, you know, spending money is an issue. It's just knowing what you're going to do, which again, also will help you be calmer when a situation arrives, when you're going to have to, you know, figure out what you're going to do.
I have a practical question here for you, Chris, because Amy mentioned it earlier, clean water. What's the best way to get drinkable water if you're worried about its quality?
Well, it depends on where you're getting it. For instance, probably the easiest way are those sort of camping style water filters that you can now get at any store for about $20.
Sure.
And, you know, they filter out bacteria and a lot of sediment. You know, there are some things they don't get, like viruses, which are rarely in water in this part of the world, but sometimes could be. And they typically won't remove sort of chemical contaminants. But that might be the easiest. But say that you have a boil water advisory and you're getting water out of your tap. Well, boiling it is really the best way. But again, you may or may not have a way to do that.
Right.
And so, you know, the easiest and a portable way are those water filters, or even, you know, the old iodine tablets that you know, we used to use in the dark ages.
Chris Begley, Amy Edelman, thank you so much for spending the hour with us and your very enjoyable emergency playbook. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
The Emergency Playbook, a bunker-free guide to disaster preparation, from our guests, Chris Begley and Amy Edelman. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.